Welcome back to America Weekend. I'm Ed Kalecki along with
Christina Stoffo.
Our next guest is a true study in courage, resilience, and never giving up. His life has been a journey from the depths of crippling drug addiction to the elation of being a world-class athlete. He recently appeared in the NBC special, The Ironman Asia Pacific Championship, which can now be seen on demand. It is quite a pleasure to say hello to Todd Crandall. Todd, welcome to the show.
Well, I must say, that's a pretty intense introduction there. Thank you very much for that.
Well, you certainly do deserve it. You are quite a story. You have completed 27 full-length Ironman triathlons around the world. Now, for people that don't know what this is no run in the park.
No.
It is a 2.4-mile swim, a 112-mile bike race, and a 26.2-mile marathon. Now, it's in that order. You don't get a break.
Now, Todd, let me just tell you, when I read this, I said, Ed, how many days is this race? And he went, oh, it's one day? Is that right?
I love that when people say, how many days do you get to do that? It's so funny. You get 17 hours to finish it.
17? Let me tell you, I run 3 miles on the treadmill. I'm about to pass out.
I walk up the stairs to get a book, and I almost pass out.
It's the 0.2 miles at the end that are the hardest.
The other the 0.2, that extra little, you know.
And I would imagine, too, when people see a 112-mile bike race, they wonder if that's a typo or not. The story here is really how your life started. Your life took a dramatic turn. Your mother committed suicide when you were only 3, and your life really changed. Take us a little through that.
Yeah, that's really where the story is, guys. I believe that people that are battling addiction, and I see it every day now as a counselor, there's usually some type of emotional trauma that occurs early on. In my case, it was the suicide of my mom. I counsel people who are coming from divorce backgrounds or sexual abuse. Something has gone wrong. Now, and I want to make this crystal clear.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say, oh, poor me, my mom died, I'm going to be a drug addict. I'm not talking about excuses. I'm talking about valid reasons why emotionally we need help. And unfortunately, people then choose to deal with that void, if you will, with drugs and alcohol, and then all the problems come from that. So society really needs to look at why is this happening and how do we help someone heal, not just focus on, oh, well, they're on drugs, they're no good, and let's get rid of them.
Now, your struggle was a 13-year struggle with drugs and with alcohol. Do we pay attention as a society, and I know what the answer is going to be, do we pay attention enough as a society to look at someone when they are dealing with emotional problems, when they deal with such traumatic things in their life, such as you did, to try to be able to stem this before it becomes something such as what you had to deal with here with a 13-year struggle?
Well, I mean, the short answer to that, Ed, is no. And let me give you an example of that. A lot of times, you know, society will say, even if something goes, the society says, well, let's talk about drug prevention, which is, yes, we want to prevent kids from using drugs. That's half of Racing for Recovery's mission. But what does that consist of? That's just saying, don't use drugs. Well, we're coming from the standpoint of saying, okay, how do we make someone not choose drugs? How do we help them heal? As opposed to saying, well, just don't do that, and somehow figure out your emotional trauma and best of luck to you. It's more in depth than just, well, don't use drugs. We want to have people heal so they can be productive members of society. And that's what, you know, again, what I do as a counselor and what my program Racing for Recovery offers mm-hmm. people.
You started drinking at a really young age, 13 years old. You transitioned to other drugs, cocaine at 16, I guess, when alcohol wasn't enough. How does a 13-year-old know that alcohol is going to numb the pain? And did people look at you as just like a problem child, like not really understanding where you came from and why you were going through what you were going through?
Boy, you guys are hitting this right on the head. I appreciate it. You know, I was the kid who had everything. You know, I mean, I came from a good home. I lived in a good neighborhood. I went to good schools. I wore the right clothes. I had a ton of friends. I was that kid. I was athletic, everything. But emotionally, I was distraught. And I was that kid that was in the principal's office. I was the kid who was acting out in class. But I was clearly having problems. And everybody just thought, well, he's a troubled kid. His mom died, you know. Let's try and figure this out somehow. And I distinctly remember taking that first drink at 13 years old. I was at a party, and these guys that I knew were drinking, and I just wanted to try it. And from taking that first sip of alcohol, I knew I was going down a different road, and I was pretty certain it wasn't going to be good.
You almost, I would imagine, feel as if you're falling into some bottomless pit, because one day becomes the next, and as you become more reliant on these drugs, and the lifestyle starts to set in, and it becomes part of the fiber and fabric of you, it's got to be such a horrible feeling to know that you're out of control. And until you get to that pivot point, and when you actually decide, that's it, I need help, it's got to be such an awful abyss that you fall into. Now, in your situation, what was that abyss? What was that moment when you knew, this is it, this has got to stop, I got to do something about this?
Well, when I'm speaking to kids, when I do talks at high schools and even on the college level, I say to them, listen, you guys, I didn't want to become who I became. But when you're talking about getting into the abyss, I literally jumped into the thing. You know, I thought, as soon as I took that first drink, from that moment on, every single time I drank, it was blackouts, arrests, you know, just absolute mayhem. So I voluntarily jumped into this, and then once I was in, I just figured, well, I'm in here, I'm going to end up dead the way my mom did, let's just get this over with. But by the grace of God, on April 15th of 1993, I got my third drunk driving charge. I blew a .36 at noon.
Holy mackerel.
And that's when it changed. That was the first time that I said, I'm done with this. I don't want it. I want something better, and by God, I'm going to get it. And that was the catalyst to improve my life.
So you ran your first triathlon in 1999, and I'm wondering if when you finally hit that point and, you know, knew that you needed to turn your life around, I've heard that running is like a natural high when you're running long distance. So I'm wondering if running became like the new drug in your life.
Well, running, let me back up a little bit, because I used to watch my stepmom, and I don't even like calling her my stepmom. She's my mom, but just so the audience doesn't get confused on that. But my stepmom was an avid runner, and she had done some triathlons. So as a kid, I always looked up to her and was like, wow, look at her go. And then I used to remember watching the Ironman triathlon back during my drug days. I came from a hockey background. So coming into running, I had no idea what this stuff really was. But once I started doing it, I'm like, oh my God, this is a good feeling. So it didn't become a new addiction. It became a new focus that was a part of a new lifestyle that I was living. But by God, that running it's key. I ran 6 miles today, and it's the catalyst that gets everything for the rest of my day going.
So how do you train for a triathlon? You're running, you're biking, you're swimming. I mean, what's the process that you have to go through to get your body just physically prepared for something that's so hard on your body?
Well, as we were talking about earlier, Ed was mentioning jumping into that abyss. Well, I jumped into the world of triathlon with both feet and had no idea really what I was doing. Got some injuries because of that lack of knowledge.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I started to figure this out, it became a training regimen that would, you know, do about 250 miles of biking a week, about 6 or 8 miles of swimming a week, and then up to about 50 miles of running a week.
Let me talk a little about the organization that you had, Racing for Recovery. You seem to be doing a tremendous amount of great work there. Tell me a little again about Racing for Recovery.
Well, Racing for Recovery is a federally approved nonprofit that I started in 2001 simply to do two things: prevent substance abuse and then show current substance abusers, their friends, their families, and the public at large that recovery is possible. We are different than the traditional programs. We offer support group meetings that are for everybody who's been affected by addiction. We do an annual 5K run. We have an annual triathlon, a golf outing. You know, I've written a couple of books. I'm a counselor speaker. You know, all these things that I've just taken the goodness that has been given to me in my life and I've turned it into a program that can be of service to help other people. And that's truly my passion today.
Well, Todd's documentary, Running with Demons, also has just been nominated for a Prism Award, Best Original DVD, which is out now. That award show that airs on FX in September. He is quite an inspiration, and he is the lesson that no matter how dark the night gets, there is always a tomorrow that can follow. Well, once again, check out that NBC special, The Ironman Asia Pacific Championship, which again can now be seen on demand. Todd Crandall, you are quite an inspiration. Continued best of luck, and thanks so much for joining us here on America Weekend.
Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it.
Well, stay with us. I'm Ed Kalenge.
Along with Christina Stoffo.
And this is America Weekend from the Envision Radio Network.
America Weekend.
Fake Green. Glad to be with you. The latest issue of Nature reports global warming could release long-dormant stores of methane gas trapped beneath the Arctic permafrost. As the ice melts, this methane release could propel an abrupt warming climate shift like the one 600 million years ago when the ice covering Earth collapsed, releasing methane that warmed the planet, melting ice worldwide. And that's considered the greatest global warming event of Earth's history. Researchers feel methane ice sheets still exist beneath the Arctic, ice sheets that are quickly melting by rising carbon dioxide levels in the Earth's atmosphere. The problem with methane is it reacts with oxygen to form carbon dioxide, the very culprit behind global warming.
Think Green with Harrison at thinkgreenradio.com.
If you're an inventor who would like to attempt to have your idea or invention patented and submitted to industry, call InventHelp. They have free information for you. Call 1-800-405-9878. That's 1-800-405-9878.
Big success in a minute with George and Mary Lynn.
You get a friend request on Facebook. Cool. Except it's from your manager. Not so cool. At least that's what most people think.
According to a study by Staffing Service Office Team, 3 out of 4 of us are uncomfortable being friended by a boss, manager, coworker, or client.
So here's how to avoid mixing business with pleasure on Facebook. First, make sure you have a LinkedIn account.
Second, when you get a Facebook friend request from an associate, tell them you like to keep professional relationships on LinkedIn and invite them to join your network there.
Instead of saying no, redirect. Then you'll maintain control over your social networks. It leads to big success.
Find big success at biggsuccess.com.
The Movie Man 6-Second Review starts now.
For kids, these fun, zany, banana-colored characters are far from despicable. They're one in a minion. The Minion!
6-Second Reviews are brought to you by Marvel's Ant-Man. Now playing.